This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 207 of FilmWax Radio. I'm Adam Shartoff, I'm your host. You remember, you've been listening to 206 prior episodes. Okay, so I've been going to Tribeca Film Festival, and each of these Q&As that I'm moderating, there's an audience there of hundreds of people, and I'm telling them about it, and maybe one out of every, group might ask me about it. But that's good. It's a good start. And also, I can recruit a few guests here and there. In fact, one of my segments today, on this episode rather, is from the Tribeca Film Festival, and we're going to put them up. Let's put them up first, because the Tribeca Film Festival is going on, and there's still probably, when you hear this, another screening at least or two of Lan Ho. The guests are, in that segment, co-directors Aaron Katz and Martha Stevens, and then they're the co-directors, and then the two actors, lead actors, is Paul Einhorn and Erlyn Nelson. Erlyn Nelson has been in a couple of his cousin Martha Stevens films, and Paul Einhorn is an Australian actor, but he's been living here in the States for a while, and he was in the recent film This Is Martin Bonner, which I loved. So it was such a pleasure, and I had the four of them. So the good news about, four different people on the show, which is not ideal, right, because it's a lot of people to listen to, but the good news is that they all sound really, really different, and you're going to be able to easily keep track of who is who, even though there's five of us talking. So I'm excited about it. It's going to be premiering in July. We'll talk about all that. It'll be in New York and in L.A. and then many, many other theaters and on demand. Lan Ho, it's a lovely story about these two former brother-in-laws who are, getting on, and they reconnect and go on a trip to Iceland together. It sounds kind of crazy, and it is kind of crazy, but it's also kind of lovely and touching and funny. And these two guys, you're going to love them to death. And so come and meet them in just a few moments. After that, I'm going to have on my friends Jeremy Saunier and Macon Blair. So Jeremy has directed this new amazing movie called Blue Ruin. It premiered at Cannes, then it went on to Sundance and Toronto, Hamptons, and now it's having its theatrical starting this Friday, April 25th. I urge you to go see it. It's another sensational movie. It's a suspense revenge drama, and Macon is like the anti-hero of all anti-heroes, so you'll want to go see that. And we just did a BK Live TV interview earlier today, and then so this is from a few weeks ago, and I'm going to post that right also. So that's the second segment. It's for Blue Ruin with filmmaker Jeremy Saunier, also known for his being a DP on such films as Septian, Putty Hill, and many, many others. And so this is, I think, his second feature that he has directed. And it's fantastic. So we'll be back in the second segment with him. Then the third one, and I owe a huge apology to this incredibly talented filmmaker named Zach Parker. Zach, please forgive me. And this show was meant to go up last week in time for his theatrical, which was last Friday. It's currently in theaters. It's currently on demand. And the name of the movie is called Proxy, and it is it is amazing. It's disturbing, it's scary, but so entertaining and of its time. I can't tell you. So all three of these films are great narrative features. Again, so even though Lan Ho doesn't come out till July, and so very few people could see it between now and then, if you are in New York, you could probably still, man, I bet you can get in to see Lan Ho. I'm doing a Q&A tonight. I'm doing another one in a couple of days with these guys here at the Tribeca Film Festival. So if you can, you'll see after you listen to this segment. Here's my conversation, again, with Aaron Katz, Martha Stevens, Paul Einhorn, and Erlyn Nelson. Okay? We'll be back in a few. feeling it's just going to be loose and kind of, you know.
Have you got signal? Yeah. Testing. Testing.
Yes,
one,
I tested this all before you came in.
Hello.
Oh, you sound very sexy. Oh, my goodness.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you want to chime in? All right. It's a podcast about independent film. It's called Film Wax Radio. And I just bring on lots of different people from really all ends of the industry, not just actors and filmmakers, but also just, you know, people that are involved in also behind the camera. And
I listened to you.
You have?
On the net, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Informative.
Oh, well. Thank you. Appreciate that. And we've already started.
We have started.
I just do that.
Hello,
because... All right, so here's the other thing. Because there is people listening and four, I might insert your names here and there and stuff like that. And we'll try not to talk over each other too much because that could be confusing for people listening in after the fact. But okay, so we'll just start right off. Thank you all for squeezing in this interview in your schedule.
Thanks for having us.
Tribeca Film Festival. Aaron Katz is here, who is the co-director of Land Ho. Aaron has made, this is your fourth feature?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have time to go into all your successful features. His co-director, Martha Stevens, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Wow, that's great. That's an affectation, I've been told. She's...
Sexy voice.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Martha... I appreciate your sitting in.
Was
this on an airplane kind of thing? That happens so much.
It was a hot summer-ish feeling day in Kentucky, outside all day, and then I left my windows open when I fell asleep at night, and it got really cold.
Okay.
So.
Well, thank you for submitting to the...
It's very sexy, though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. That's not professional. I'm sorry. You guys have a relationship. That you're also listening to Paul Einhorn, who is...
That's me.
Familiar to independent film audiences in America for his work on, of course, Land Ho, which, well, many people have not had an opportunity to see that, but they may remember him from This is Martin Bonner, which is a great movie.
Thank you.
Congratulations on that. And Dr. Earl Lynn Nelson is also joining us.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, that's going to sound great on the podcast, your voice. God bless you. Straight from New Orleans?
No, I'm from Kentucky.
Kentucky originally. Bourbon country.
I live in Kentucky now.
Oh, very good.
Since Katrina.
Okay.
I had to go home and take care of my mom. She got sick, and then I decided to stay.
Okay. Is she still with us? Or?
No, I lost her Christmas 3 years ago.
Okay. Sorry for that.
98.
Wow. She couldn't just...
She got everything she wanted. Granddaughter on her birthday, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, she didn't see her son's movie debut, though.
Nope.
I'm really bad with talk about this because, venturing into the mortality and stuff, it's where I feel the least comfortable terrain. But it sort of is the theme. Yeah.
Segue.
No, but it is the sort of the subtext of Land Ho, right?
It is, very much, yes.
Okay, just do you want to get Aaron, or do you want to give the synopsis?
Sure, it's about these two guys, Erlen, who plays Mitch, and Paul, who plays Colin. Uh-huh. And they're a couple of guys who get together and go to Iceland. And, yeah, like you said, the movie is a bit about mortality, but even more so, I think it's about living while you've got it, because you might die tomorrow. And actually, this came up earlier. We were doing a Q&A. And someone asked how it apply, you know, how the movie applies to, you know, people that are the same age as these guys. And Earl Lynn said that, you know, it's about all ages, because, you know, at any age you lose your job, you lose a loved one, and at any age you could die tomorrow. So, it you know, the movie's really about appreciating what you've got while you've got it, and about these two guys finding a way to connect and feel like it's worth it.
Martha, how did you guys end up collaborating? I know you've made a couple of features of your own that have hit major festivals, and this is your third or fourth feature?
This is my third.
Your third feature? Did you guys meet originally on the circuit, on that festival circuit? Did you know each other from school?
I mean, Aaron and I have known each other since I was 18. So we've known each other for 12 years. Oh, okay. We went to the North Carolina School of the Arts.
Let it be
together.
Noted I didn't ask for your age, but you just offered that
I'm
up.
I'm 30 years old.
That's a great age.
Great age. I have a funny, do you, this is off the subject, but I officially know I'm 30 because I watched Bull Durham the other day, and I was really attracted to Kevin Costner.
Oh, come on. No, that's just being...
No, it's a coming-of-age thing.
Okay.
Women become attracted to Kevin Costner only when they're 30.
Oh.
Over.
How old do you have to be attracted to, like, you know, Gary Cooper or Cary Grant?
I mean...
I think those are any age could be attracted. But I do think there is a bit of a... It's not so much their place in history.
It's more about their dadness. It's like your next-door neighbor's dad or something. Like,
yeah. And he is the proto-all-American type actor, right? I mean,
yeah,
of our age.
I guess, Tom Hanks.
I guess growing up in, you know, the late 80s and early 90s, mm-hmm. your mother would, you know, be all hot and bothered by Kevin Costner. And so as a child, you were very confused why, like, this moment in Prince of Thieves is just, like, why this is being rewound constantly. And
that's the I'm turning into my mother stage. That's
exactly.
It
yeah.
It's like I pop on the Bonnie Raitt and I pop on the Kevin Costner and I'm my mother.
Right.
And I've now officially started drinking white wine. Totally, I'm my mom.
It's working for you. I like the whole thing.
All right.
Okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
30s are wonderful. You were.
Well, yeah. We'll see.
I can't ever remember them.
Paul.
It's back in about, that would for you be like about 1905 through 1915. Is that right?
Thank you very much, Aaron.
Paul, since you had the mic, you were an established actor.
That's because I don't want to give it to him.
Well, he can take Martha's at any moment, but he's such a gentleman. He's sitting there.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. And you're from Perth.
I'm from Perth. Melbourne, mm-hmm. and then Perth,
okay.
and then Sydney.
Oh, okay. But your formative years were in Perth. Is that the idea? And then you moved.
My formative years were actually in Melbourne. That's where I first got laid. And very Melbourne. And then in Perth is where I actually learned how to get laid. In Sydney.
That was last year he got laid, by the way.
That's good. His formative year.
I shouldn't. Actually, why am I talking about this?
Formative.
No, yes,
formative 1 minute.
Oh, no.
Okay. I don't know why that came up, but, that, you know.
It's okay.
It's Martha's voice. It's Martha's voice. It
came partially up.
It's like, ooh, 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 ooh.
You guys.
I want to talk like she does.
Well, yeah, I'd say the Australian accent is kind of, in this, especially in this country, probably is works for you, right?
I have been told many times when I've been extremely rude to a woman or a group of women, I say, I apologize, and they say, with that accent, you can say whatever you like.
That's great. I was going to say you could just say, I apologize, I'm Australian.
I don't understand your social customs here.
I think you guys do have such distinctively different voices that this really does work, because y'alls have different, very different, the two gentlemen actors here.
Actually, Erlin did make a note of that.
Yeah, somebody asked us if we could switch roles. I said, I don't think you could take this hillbilly accent and make it into Australian. You know, I don't think anybody could, you know.
I'd like to hear it be attempted, though.
Yeah. Erlin, can you do an Australian accent?
Yeah.
I was trying to think of that pub in Lightning Ridge in Australia that I spent some time at several years ago, mining opals and diamonds. And I can remember, bloke. That's about it for me.
All
bloke.
Right. All right.
Bloke.
I could do a little bit of one myself. Right. You know, it's more like a, it's more of a frame of mind than anything else.
Oh.
There you
it's
go.
Actually,
there you go.
It's the opposite of American. Americans, they have R's in their words, right? But Australians, there's no R's anywhere.
No?
Right? Australia.
Right.
There's no R.
Australia. Right.
Paul, can you do an American accent?
I can do an American accent.
Can you? Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard this.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to the show, everybody. We're sitting here in Manhattan or somewhere in New York, and I'm trying to do an American accent.
You almost got... you did a little Southern accent, too.
It was a little Southern. That's easy.
And a little Jack Nicholson in there? Well,
you want to be on the top or on the bottom?
There you...
It sounds like you came off a box of Wheaties.
I don't know what that means.
What is that reference?
Just...
A professional.
Oh,
I'm supposed to be the one that reins everything in and makes sense out of this, so I'll occasionally do that, but not in a way that is in any way trying to... I'm just guiding everybody back to this movie believe it or not, it had its world premiere, I believe, at the Sundance Film Festival, right?
Yes.
Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
And now here you are at this festival here in New York City, this little thing. And the movie is about, because I don't know if you even had a chance to really get the full synopsis, but right, it's about two former brother-in-laws, but who are quasi-estranged, I would say, probably, right? And are...
two guys that were best friends who were married to sisters. After several years, I divorced my wife, and his wife forbid him to have anything to do with me.
Okay.
And after 20-some years, she dies of cancer. And that's...
So now that both wives are no longer in the picture, you guys have an opportunity to reconnect.
But he got screwed on his second wife, too, which is in the movie.
Right.
And so... jump from the frying pan into the fire.
Right. That's not an uncommon... that's almost an American problem. That, I don't know, maybe it's in Australia, too, the idea of
so
of
many
getting...
women, so little time. Yeah?
No, more okay. just making running into something to heal, to try to quick fix.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I think it's a manifestation of loneliness amongst a lot of people. You know, they'd rather be with someone imperfect than to be with someone who is, or not be with anyone at all. I think you're perfectly right, yeah.
But in a sense, you're both at a period when you've lost your wives and your careers, too, that you're now ready for human connection, and I don't think either of you are thinking, oh, this could be with a male friend, you know, that you haven't really explored that. And then Mitch, who buys you both tickets without Colin, the character of Colin, knowing it, buys two tickets to Iceland to have a vacation there. And at first, Colin's put off by it, and over the gradually warms up. That's
correct,
fine.
Yeah. And you guys, Colin's more reserved than Mitch.
In some ways, yeah. It's
in very some ways.
No, but always. I would say yes and no. I would say that there's bluster. Mitch has the bluster, and is more immediate or, you know, superficially outgoing. But by the end, we see in the last scenes that you're actually the Colin character actually is also not so shy.
You know, that's... it's bloody good writing and bloody good direction, because
there you go.
I find that in films that are either critical or critical and popular hits, it's because the director's had a clear vision. And as an actor, I don't go there. I do what's on the page. And it's when you hear people talk about the motivations and the outcomes and the sweet spots that you go, wow, well, that wasn't me, because it was these two. Mm-hmm. You know, really, I'm serious.
Well, I think it's interesting because sort of by the last 10 minutes of the movie, they switch places in a lot of ways.
Right.
So you have him going to bed early and doing a crossword puzzle, and he's with the hooking up with the lady. Mm-hmm. And
he meaning Colin.
Colin, yeah. Colin, mm-hmm. Colin, mm-hmm. you know, meets this woman. And But I think, you know, throughout the movie, Mitch's character is always pushing himself to be what he thinks he should be, which is this, like, party guy, outgoing. He's always getting the plan together to go out and have a good time.
A glass of scotch in one hand, or bourbon in your case, and the...
not scotch.
Not bourbon. Oh, I'm sorry.
Shine. Moonshine.
Oh, okay. That's
or tequila.
Or tequila.
Oh, very good. I'm sorry. You're from Kentucky, not your character. You got the glass of hooch in one hand and your joint in the other. Okay.
I mean, I think it's a nice, peaceful moment there in the last 10 minutes where we see Mitch sort of be comfortable with just being by himself and taking a quiet moment.
Be inside solitude. It's that.
I think the movie in a lot of ways is about letting all the things in life that stop us from being who we want to be and appreciating every moment, like letting those fall away. And for each of the characters, that's something different, and they kind of need each other to get to that place. And that's the kind of the ultimate destination where they find themselves in the end of the movie. Not to spoil that, I feel like we just talked about the end of the movie.
A little bit, it's true. But I think you're okay. Those that have a little bit more information, it's okay. And it's really not about... the movie's really a character story, and it's a it's more about their relationship than it is about like an ending or a, like
there's that big twist in the end.
Right. They
like Body Heat.
Exactly. So talk about your, obviously, the casting. Had you seen Martin Bonner, or did you already know Paul ahead of before that? Or
we're friends with Chad, who directed it, and so we both watched it, and we were really impressed by Paul.
Yeah, I mean, we had seen... I remember the first time I saw Martin Bonner, we didn't have the idea for this movie yet. Martha hadn't gotten in touch with me with this idea, and I just, as soon as I saw Paul, I was thought... Got to work with this guy sometime. Mm-hmm. Got to find a way to work with Paul. And
that happened pretty quick then.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was because Martin Bonner was just the year before. And yeah, I'm so glad that that ended up happening.
Thank you.
And yeah, it's, I mean, and it's just, it's interesting to think about how, Paul, if you hadn't come to audition for Martin Bonner, you know, from Seattle to Los Angeles, if Chad had like posted the listing on a different day, maybe you wouldn't have noticed it. And yeah, that led to Martin Bonner, and if he hadn't made Martin Bonner, we'd never would have met.
Yeah, I'd still be in Seattle wondering what the hell the meaning of life was.
Is that where you are? You're
yeah, I'm based in Seattle.
Seattle,
yeah.
Washington.
But I do fly to L.A.
Only for Chad.
And, only for Chad. Yeah. And Chad and Aaron and Martha.
So the big question, I guess, would be then, how did you end up casting Earl?
Got you it. Have to ask. Ask them about how they right, cast right.
And, and the question is then, if the okay, I will. I'm going to ask Aaron and Martha about that. But then the follow-up would be, this is your first acting role?
Third time.
Third. Okay.
I did some work in Martha's other two movies.
Okay, so there's the connection there.
We're cousins.
Oh, okay, and that works into the
her mother
story.
And I are first cousins.
Got it.
So just like
not
characters
an uncle.
In the movie.
He's not your uncle.
No, his cousin.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't. I mean, the casting was the original idea. Martha texted me about a year ago, just a little more than a year ago, and the text read, "Want to make a movie together with Earl Lynn, and we'll go to Iceland," or something along those lines.
I have been to Iceland.
And then, you know, we didn't write any of it till we'd also cast Paul in the movie. It's not like Paul auditioned for the movie. We just saw him in mm-hmm. Chad's movie, and that was enough. And we wrote with them in mind. And actually, the two women in the movie, Carrie Krause and Elizabeth McKee, Carrie went to school with us, and Elizabeth is my wife. And we also wrote with them in mind, too. And I think for both of us, we really like writing with people in mind so we can hear. You know, Erlyn, I'd never met you, but I knew your voice from Martha's other movies, and it was so great to be able to write, you know, hearing that.
It's really fun to write for Earl Lynn, if you can imagine.
How much did you participate in the collaborating in terms of your dialogue, Earl? Did you?
I've got to turn that over to Martha or Aaron.
No.
We did the percentage thing.
No, let's get that percentage thing.
Well, it's just
getting
so,
old.
I know, but I'm just saying is that, you know, it's percentage. We had to put something because people ask that all the time.
I know, and the reason is because when you see the movie, those listening to this, that to capture quite your in particular, you know, I would say style of expressing yourself,
delivery,
like you know, I don't know that who could write that.
Known him my whole life,
but you have known him all your life. That's true.
So it's you just sort of, and then I think one thing Aaron and I did was. Like, yeah, Aaron is familiar with watching my other movies, but also I had written another script for Earl Lynn, and I passed that off to Aaron to show him that dialogue that I had written for Earl Lynn. So it's just, I don't know, it's you just got to put your mind in a real filthy place and sort of enjoy it. You know, it's really, that's the best part about writing dialogue. I love it so much because I love, you know, being in someone else's mind for that time period, you know, that I'm writing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a few different stages to it. First was we wrote the stuff in Kentucky, which we shot earlier. We shot in May. And so that, there was even, it even got a little more informed because not only were we imagining Earl Lynn, but we actually saw these two as their characters interacting. And then we wrote the, you know, the rest of the feature based on that. And then when we shot in Iceland, every night we would go over to their hotel rooms. And oftentimes Paul or Olin would say, I don't think I would say that. Like, this reminds me of this kind of thing. And I think that'd make a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. And so we just go with that. And especially because, you know, we're at a different place in life than Paul and Earl Lynn. I think it was really important for all of us to collaborate and come up with stuff that felt real, that felt like, you know, what you would say in life.
Yeah, and then there was a lot of on set. There was like a spark, and we would, oh, let's say this instead. You know, something would just come to us that was especially funny at that moment.
Yeah, oftentimes, actually, that was one advantage of having the two directors is oftentimes we'd, you know, do a take and then we'd get an idea and have a quick little conference between ourselves. And then, you know, we'd go off like, you know, maybe I'd talk to Paul and Martha would talk to Earl Lynn and we might tell them opposite things about what was going to happen in a take that was coming up.
Yeah.
And we, you know, if you have one director, then one, you kind of have to flip back and forth. But we actually could totally wind them up and then set them going at the same time, which was really fun.
I'd watch them, right, and they'd be talking. So Aaron or Martha would go over to Earl Lynn, and Aaron or Martha would come to me, and I'd think, oh, God, what are they setting up? They're setting something up.
Yeah, they got increasingly suspicious of us having a quiet conference.
It kept you in the moment because you're always going to be surprised by what the next person said.
You guys really seem to enjoy hanging out and talking about the film. What's the trajectory going forward? Are you working out the rest of the distribution and all that at this stage? And
the movie's coming out July 11th.
Oh, okay, good, very good.
New York and L.A., and then it's going to be a rolling release all summer, different cities.
All right, I couldn't remember. Very good.
Distributed by Sony Pictures Classics.
Okay, I've heard of that one.
39,000 per site per weekend.
39,000. I would
3,000 per screen. Per
oh,
weekend.
Very good. I see.
I was thinking more like 3,000 screens, 39,000 per screen. That sounds reasonable, right?
Yeah, 3,000. You know, like I'm reading up all the figures and I'm thinking, what's going to be successful? And I'm thinking 3,000 per screen is really good.
Well, we're really excited for the release, and we do have a lot of fun talking about the movie because we had a great time making the movie. We all were living in the same places. We all spent every day together, and it was a relatively small crew, and a lot of people knew each other going in, and those who didn't really became part of the family. And, you know, I feel like, you know, Erlen and Paul, you guys are always bringing up how it really was like a family for you, you know, meeting all the crew.
There was a momentum in the film. And it was like a relentless momentum. Every day you rolled and you rolled and you rolled. And everyone rolled together, even though you might have, you know, occasionally not been in the right mood. But I think I fell in love with Iceland. I totally fell in love with it. And
how long were you there overall? I'm sorry.
3 weeks.
They were there for like 3.5. And then Aaron and myself and the producers were there for about 5.5 weeks.
The people in Iceland were fantastic, friendly, nice people. And they speak damn good English. And
do they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you'd go back if there were, let's say, a sequel?
I don't think we'd go back to Iceland if there was a sequel.
Okay.
We're thinking TV show, maybe.
Hawaii.
And then each season of the TV show is a new destination.
What if the show's real low budget and all we can afford to do is go to, like, Sheboygan?
Just go, yeah. Go to Branson, Missouri, and take in some shows.
Branson Convention Center.
Yeah, we're talking about land ho 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 and go save the North Pole from Santa Claus.
You're gonna save the North Pole from Santa Claus?
There's a lot of people that was on the crew said they want to do Aloha. Land Aloha.
I really wish we had another half hour. We'll do the maybe we can all get together again in July. If
Perfect.
You guys are in New York.
We'll be back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The film's called Land Ho. It's co-directed by Martha Stevens and Aaron Katz and stars Erlen Nelson and Paul Einhorn. And
thank you. Guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. know, it's very hard to do a segment with so many people. I usually do one or two people, sometimes a third, but four people, very rare. And I only did it because I really wanted the actors in the conversation with, and I know I can talk to Aaron and Martha again when in July, but I wasn't, you know, you never know. Will I get these actors in? And maybe we will, but I probably would, if that happens again, maybe I'll just break them up. But I hope it was an entertaining segment. All right, so I met Jeremy some time ago. I think I hosted a DVD release party way back for Michael Tully's film, Septian. And Jeremy I met through that and a few other occasions. He is the cinematographer on that film. Blue Ruin I'd been reading about for some time. So all of a sudden, there's opportunities came to talk to Jeremy and his leading man, Macon. Now, I mentioned over the months that I've been doing these TV bits, these spots, and I have other work I'm doing with Brick, which is this Brooklyn Independent Arts and Media Center in downtown Brooklyn. I'm dealing with this lovely person there named Lee. This is her husband. It's just coincidentally, turns out. And so I'm all the more happy then to talk to these guys. But I can tell you right now, I can get behind this film. It's one of the best, revenge thrillers I've seen in years. So you will check it out. That movie is called Blue Ruin, and here is my conversation with Jeremy and Macon.
I apologize for the mystery. I don't mean to scare you. You're not in any trouble. I just thought you should be somewhere safe when you found out. With somebody. He's going to be released. I don't know how much they are missed. It's an awful thing he did to them.
Same. I know this is personal. That's how you'll fail.
I'd forgive you if you were crazy. But you're not. You're weak.
Welcome to Filmics Radio. Jeremy Solnier.
Are we starting
here? Yeah, we've already started. Oh, this mic's already been on for about five. No, it's okay.
Thank you very much for having me.
Macon Blair, yeah. Good to see you guys.
Likewise, Adam.
With a mixture of regret and pleasure, last night I watched the film, and I only say regret because I had to watch it on a computer because time had run out.
Sure.
But I'll come and see it again. It is a rarely when I can say, with all honesty, this is a movie you can watch right away again because of first of all, making your performance. And just the story, it's so full and rich. You could really, I would look forward to seeing it on the big screen.
Thank you. I think we both agree that it's probably one of those movies that plays a lot better on the big screen anyway. So we hope you enjoy it the second time as well.
Because what I find is, and a testament to it, is that normally when I do watch something at home on a computer or on the or I'll hook it up to the TV, but when it's still something even smaller than that, pointing to a monitor behind us, that...
Oh,
it's easy to get distracted. And say, I'm going to run and push the. But when you're in a movie theater, that doesn't happen. You know, you're kind of trans. You're playing. But with this movie, I watch all the way through.
That's great. That's so good, that's a high compliment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You
well
sure
done.
You didn't email anybody or check Facebook? Maybe.
I checked the Blue Ruin Facebook page. Okay. Touché.
No, it's true.
No.
We are film fans first, so we absolutely designed this movie to be better the second or third time around. And the narrative is designed to empower audiences to sort of fill in the gaps. And there's actually a very detailed history, this whole revenge saga of Blue Ruin. There's a very detailed timeline, and every character has their own story and own perspective. But... we wanted to
to leave that as this really weighty undercurrent and this service level movie. It's very visceral. It's visual. There's very little expository exchange going on there. So it is ideally a deep well for viewers to revisit and see that there is much more going on and that the characters are talking amongst themselves and not to the audience, because it just helps.
That it avoids hand-holding you through the story.
Exactly. It's such an insult when you're watching something that your intelligence is just not respected, and that we have seen so many films, the genre audiences and the art house audiences. We know the drill. And we don't need more than the essentials. And it's actually more enjoyable for audiences to be left to themselves to figure things out and know that it adds to the realism and the arc of the movie that the characters are talking amongst themselves, not directly to the audience, and we're not talking about narrative convenience or making sure we have justification for certain actions. And I think it does. I think that's why this film broke through, is that we leave so much to the audience.
Jeremy, you wrote, directed, and shot the film.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And why don't you give a little bit of a synopsis, just so people, you say it's a review. They're almost the entire film could be, you have to avoid this. This is one film where you definitely have to be careful how much you give away.
Yeah, it's just the hardest thing for me to condense the whole film.
Okay, well, I could do it. Or Macon, you want to give it a shot?
Macon, are you cool with this? My brain just short circuits and I start stuttering. So Macon, can you do this? Can you
give it a shot? Macon Blair is the lead actor, plays the character Dwight, who is the center of the film and is also the executive producer on the film.
Yeah, that was just sort of like a catch-all title that I got. I just kind of like swept up where sweeping up was needed, kind of helping with...
It was very well swept, the set.
Well, everybody wore a lot of different hats. I mean, obviously Jeremy had, three or four jobs that he was credited for in addition to the dozen others that he wasn't. And every crew member was probably doing two or three jobs. So, yeah, everybody was pitching in. The movie is about a homeless man who receives a dreadful bit of news, which prompts him to... return to his hometown to carry out an act of vengeance, the results of which are disastrous. And he spends much of the story trying to dig his way out of this hole that he's dug for himself.
Well done.
That's pretty good.
Gee, write that down, Jeremy, because he has, what is it called? Just reduced it to a very...
Well, we've had... You've
had a lot of these.
We've been kind of we've been asked to summarize it a bunch, and so there's plenty of other people out there that were like, "My God, they summarized it for 20 minutes. That's
Without
not a summary."
And it's funny. I was just talking to David Gordon Green yesterday, and if you can believe it or not, that show already went up. It's already, you can hear it already. How quickly I turned around.
Internet age.
Because it opened today, Joe. We were talking, and he was saying it's sort of like you felt like it was a bit of a Western. When that film, which I could see somewhat, but this film also, Jeremy, earlier you mentioned, it's an homage to some degree to, if not to other films and genres, to the audiences mm-hmm. that love movies, and this has like that structure to it. But you in those Westerns, of course, we knew in the Hollywood Westerns, we knew exactly how it was going to turn out. Unless Sam Peckinpah was making the film. But in this one, really, no idea where it was going to go. No idea whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough for independent filmmakers never knowing where they're going to premiere or how they'll be distributed going in. But we use it to our advantage in that we knew that we had to break through at a festival for anyone to see this film, and that the great advantage there is that no one knows the film was about. And so we made sure like the title was sort of enigmatic and melancholy and not aggressive and didn't
which we haven't actually even I don't think mentioned. I will in the intro, but I don't think we actually mentioned the title.
Oh yeah,
Blue Ruin.
But it was great because I sat down originally to write more of a standard genre film. I wanted to showcase my prowess for like on-screen murders and choreographing death and just sort of, I guess, that was my intention. I wanted to fulfill that sort of childhood fantasy of making these Reagan-era action movies.
Oh,
but
okay.
It didn't seem right, and I was at sort of inner conflict within myself. And so it was very cool because the standard bedrock of revenge, we've seen it 1,000 times in movies, and the key here was to thrust an unlikely protagonist in the middle of it and let him flail, and that way the film found life, and we found ourselves in what we consider uncharted territory, and we were surprised, like, how come we haven't seen this before? But yeah, Macon was originally hesitant to play the role of Dwight, because when I pitched him, like, we're going to put you at the helm of this movie, and it's going to be a revenge drama, he was hesitant.
Yeah, please respond.
Oh well, yeah, the hesitance was from my misunderstanding of at that early stage where Jeremy was going to go with it, and thinking that he was going to do what he was just describing, which is the very standard two-fisted, you know, dispatch the bad guy and then you give a cool one-liner, mm-hmm. and just like badasses all around type of movie. And I was like, come on, that's not going to fly with me playing that part. And he kind of held my hand through the process of explaining that that's totally the point, that we're going to have this wrong for the part character doing right. this very standard sort of revenge movie. And that made much more sense.
Yet, this character, Dwight, he's somehow, on some level, extremely shrewd, his instincts. He manages to really make a lot of very quick, accurate decisions, at least to some, you know, to a certain point.
It's like he's clever, but he's not smart.
No, well, within this context of really doing something really stupid and misguided.
Right.
And, you know, just really wrong-headed. Within there, though, he's making a series of, and connecting with people. Let's not forget the emotional connections he makes with his sister, with an old school friend, with or childhood chum.
Yeah.
In his own way, it's a really interesting sort of a journey.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it was a ton of fun to play, and like Jeremy was saying, it was sort of a return to the types of movies that we grew up trying to make together. But at the same time, it was a much more kind of stark and serious and in some ways vulnerable part than I was used to playing, which was challenging but also a lot of fun, and I felt like a great opportunity. And so we just kind of both chewed into it with whatever we could bring.
Interestingly, I noticed one thing about your idea of on-screen deaths and murder and injuries. Nobody says ow. Nobody says ow. It's like you were shot. I won't say any more than that. Your body was several occasions
the
target. Yeah, it was. Yeah. But I don't think you ever just said ow. You just sort of.
Well, there was a couple of. It's sort of
son
like
son of a bitch.
Like, if know, there are like scales of how badly he is hurt and what the degree of pain is, I think if it's down at the bottom end of the scale, then he probably winced or gasped or then
then you get
the middle range, then he's shrieking, but then when you get to the top of the scale, I think it's more about him being in shock and just
he's had
the wind knocked out of him. And
but you're already numb on a certain level, I mean, that which speaks
from
to the
beginning,
the story,
sure.
You know, yeah, broader story, so you're numb, so and you do, at one point, you are unconscious. We should add that. So.
Yeah.
How did you guys meet? And like, how did that? How did you end up playing? I know you sort of put this. You told him he was playing this role. It sounds like you informed him, Jeremy, that Macon was going to play the role. But you know, what's your background? Have you guys collaborated before?
Absolutely, yeah. That's how it all came about. He gifted me this role because we've been working together literally since we were little kids. We were part of a group of 6 or 8 young men and a couple of ladies, too, that would just run around the neighborhood with cameras and make movies. And
What neighborhood was that?
This was Alexandria, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And we all came up to New York and tried to make a go of that professionally. And so, yeah, we've made some short films, some spec commercials, and then Jeremy's first feature in 2007 was an ensemble kind of sleazy horror comedy called Murder Party, and I had a supporting part in that. And then,
oh, yeah. I just had seen something about it in the notes, I guess, and I was trying to...
Totally different animal.
Oh, I like, realize. It sounded
completely
like...
opposite. And by design, like, you know, we love that movie. It's our first film. We think it's a lot of fun for all of its flaws, but it's... at the time, it was not representative, I think, of what Jeremy wanted to do or could do, and this is probably more a step in that direction.
Yeah, Murder Party was, I mean, it actually was, of course, what we wanted to do, but we didn't realize it would then define all we could do as far as the industry was concerned. And it came out in 2007. It was shot in 2006. But it was a sort of contained indie, dialogue-driven movie. And there were a lot of those. That was the year Mumblecore broke.
Mm,
and so yeah. I was definitely a little bit, I felt on the outside because a lot of people had films with white people talking in a room, and I at least had the decency to kill them all off.
Wearing my plaid.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I felt our film...
I stepped on your punchline. Sorry.
our film got overlooked, I thought, because I really thought there was actually more... It was on the surface level a goofy Halloween night romp with lots of splatter and gore, but there was some legit character exchange going on there, and Megan's character in particular broke my heart. And we thought it would lead to more things, and it could have, and mm-hmm. it maybe would have, but mm-hmm. things didn't line up. So after 2007, when it was released, you know, it was picked up by Magnolia Pictures, and that was a coup for us. We were very grateful. And we have a solid amount of fans for that film. But, yeah, so as far as industry was concerned, it was a fart in the wind. And we just kind of went back to our day jobs and carried on. But as time went by and technology evolved and these cameras that people were using to shoot movies got smaller and cheaper and better at the same time, it was then the long play. And I went back into narrative storytelling as a cinematographer and helped
right.
really good friends make awesome movies.
Like Matt Porterfield,
Mike Tully, Nate Meyer, Brian Salveson. I mean, I learned so much from them, and I was just back on the scene. Wasn't making real money, but I was not spending my own because Murder Party was self-financed,
yeah.
and that kind of broke me and took away my ability to be my own executive and make decisions and greenlight my own projects. So I helped others with theirs, and it was fantastic. It was like film school part two. But I was also able to see where I thought there were cracks in the indie filmmaking model, and I thought priorities were often reversed, and schedules and logistics and famous people were the first consideration, and then the script that people would workshop for years was secondary. And so I started designing how we would shoot Blue Ruin even before I wrote the script.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about giving myself the time to do something proper, which is 30 days. I thought it was a good, luxurious schedule.
By today's standards.
Indie standards. Yeah,
right.
It's
always, usually you have like 3 weeks or something right
it's
now.
It's always across the board. It's 3 6-day weeks. You have 18 shoot days. No matter what the length of the script is or the content they're in, it just seems to be standard for just budgeting. And I get that and I respect that. But also as a camera person, I was realizing I kept pushing the biggest, baddest camera on the market on production. And I was really into doing the best job I could and delivering the highest quality visuals possible. But I realized after a certain point, because of these crazy schedules and the priorities being sort of inverted, that directors would sometimes find themselves in positions where they knew what they wanted exactly.
Mm, yeah.
But they didn't have the time to workshop scenes and get them there. And so I forewent the big bad camera for Blue Ruin. And again, before I was had any money to shoot the movie, I bought the camera we were going to use. It was the Canon C300, just came out. And I was like, I'm going to use this for both my corporate video day jobs and try and get rentals on it. But this is the camera that we're going to own. And Megan and I can go do bizarre scenes on the beach, or I can get sunsets or capture lightning plates, whatever I needed to get done, it would just be in my minivan or in my house ready to go.
You mean like just those stock shots and that kind of thing?
So often on a film set, like, you'll have an unscripted title sequence, right. or we need pickups of downtown Maine, or yeah. we need this or that, and just not time to do that, because you'll right. burn time on a schedule.
It's amazing.
You yeah. have to do six pages
a day. You're kind of building a collection of stock clips or what have you.
I had it just for that power to do that whenever I wanted, but I actually started buying props when I was writing the very first draft of the script. I was like, this
guns?
Symbol of commitment. And the main thing was Macon was growing this beard and we had no actual prospect of making this movie. It was looking grim, but we had done it before for Murder Party, and we had financially, my wife and I had somewhat recovered from that loss. Macon was hungry. I was hungry. And we just decided that with Macon having a son due the following winter, me having my third daughter due, that this window we had to sort of break through and become filmmakers was absolutely going to close. And we had to grow up and get real jobs that would help our family, you know, sustain themselves. So it was great. I mean, it was a convergence of, you know, this 30-year history together making movies, the necessity of just needing work, and the proximity to the film industry where we could see what was going on, that was right and what was wrong. We decoded it, reconstructed it, and built Blue Ruin from scratch. And when I wrote the script, Macon and I had discussed available locations. I wrote the picture car to be one that was in my parents' driveway at the time. So, I mean, we built sure. it all from scratch.
From an economic...
Right.
Yeah. Just doing it economically responsibly. And
totally. And doing that from pre-script phase meant there was no compromise. And it wasn't like settling for stuff that was available after you written this grand vision. It was just about knowing what you had at your disposal and building the narrative that best suited you and the available resources. And it worked out great because we were able to pull it off for a very, very low budget without a single compromise to the page.
One of the things that I really liked about Jeremy owning that camera was maybe it's a spoiler, but there's shots at the end of the result of damage from a storm, which was, you know, down trees and stuff like that. And that was actually not in the script originally. And that's an example of we were just on a location shoot in Alexandria, and the storm happened to come through and it messed up the neighborhood. And Jeremy had the camera that he owned in his car and just sort of thought about it for a second and decided, why not? It's great, free, amazing production value. Let's just get a bunch of footage of this and then sort of figured out how it worked correctly into the story. And so those shots that you see are actually just things that were grabbed sort of on the run. And that was kind of the freedom that owning that camera afforded us, and just grab stuff that you wouldn't otherwise. You couldn't plan for that. You certainly couldn't set it up, and you certainly couldn't pay for it. But if you have the latitude to grab it just when it happens to pop up, then you can make use of it. So
noticed one interesting bit of casting, I guess, is going to come up invariably, right?
Eve.
Well, for people of my generation, of course.
Buzz.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, again, this is, we'll get this is a giveaway. This could be a nice little, the percentage of people that will listen to the show versus those who don't, who will see the movie, I think it's okay to mention to those people that are, that Eve Plum, who was perhaps best known for playing Jan Brady in the Brady Bunch back in the day, in the 70s, is in this film. And I will say, Eve Plum can finally close the, what's the expression? The lid is shut for Jan Brady, finally.
That was maybe the goal? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, in this point in her life, she can now move on, finally. I think she's had a few dramatic films in her past since the Brady Bunch, but I think that this is the one that
turns the corner.
that might turn the corner. No, she's terrifying in this.
Right. Yeah. It's fine to reveal. Like, you know, we have Buzz from Home Alone telling a friend how to murder someone. We have Jan Brady with a full auto tech 9 in this film. And for me, I am a relative ignoramus when it comes to who's who and casting. So I actually cast them. I didn't know who the hell they were.
Really?
Or I didn't know who Eve Plum was. I had seen Jan Brady growing up, but I didn't know who Devin was. I just knew Macon, my best friend. So it's because
must be so nice to be you.
I'm just out of the loop. Macon's an encyclopedia. He knew everybody.
Yeah.
But
But what was cool is they were cast on the merits of their acting, and that was it. But it is fun now to reveal that, and it's part of these cool career arcs and trajectory of everyone. But they were both amazing.
Yes.
And really, those two in particular, I really leaned on them to bring stuff to the role, and so I could be on autopilot during the shoot. But Eve Plum came to this finale sequence, and she just brought so much more than I intended to it, and layers of depth and emotion that made it a much more profound experience for everybody. And Devin was just too good to pass up. He actually auditioned for the role of Teddy first, which is a different role, and I thought his audition was amazing, and he showed a level of commitment to his part and a physicality I needed, and also an intimate knowledge of the script. He knew the script backwards and forwards.
This is the actor who played
Devin Mitrick.
Who played the...
He auditioned for Teddy,
right.
Eventually played by Kevin Colloquy.
Oh, okay, very good.
But Devin was too good to pass up. Devin, for the dynamic between Dwight and Teddy, had to be much different. Mm-hmm. But you know, as an independent film director that has not really proven himself to the industry, and there was not a lot of attraction based on name value for Macon or myself, when you see someone that good come in audition, and then you wiggle around and you accommodate them. So I rewrote the role of Ben slightly to accommodate Devin, just because he had the perfect chemistry, and I wanted to put him and Macon together in scenes. And I think Devin remains the crowd favorite to this day.
Yes. Yeah. The casting is really great all around.
Amy Hargraves.
Oh, sure.
I didn't know who she was either, but she was the very first person to audition for a role, which was Sam, Dwight's sister.
Uh-huh.
It's like a New York apartment hunting. Like you might see the best apartment first and have no idea, then go shopping around. But when I saw her, I didn't know she was on Homeland or had like a successful career. I just saw her as Sam delivering the lines that I had written, and I was blown away. And indeed, a tear came to my eye. And we took a week to actually make the official offer, but I think she was cast instantaneously in the brain, and she was the one to beat. And I didn't know, like, are we going to get more of these? But we didn't. Amy came through and just...
That just happens.
Yeah. And she nailed it. And it's like a room like we're in now, like a sort of an office room with fluorescent lights, and not the best venue to really dazzle a director on a cheapo video camera. But she, like, her performance broke through that environment and just spoke to me. And we were very grateful to have her on board. And she was a huge part of making this film legit. And making Macon, who was my best friend and I could use and abuse and had full trust in as a physical actor, she made Macon step up and be a real deal actor that had to say actual lines in that diner scene. I mean, that was for me a revelation. You know, I was shocked by both Amy and the guy that I knew for over 30 years. Like, and yeah. I knew we had
Careful.
A home run.
Right, you may have just created a monster here, because I know that anything could happen, but I mean, if this isn't a great calling card for you and what you're capable of,
yeah.
There is no comedy in the movie, though. I will say, often I try to find the humor. There are moments of release and of tension and whatnot during the film, but I wouldn't say there's any light.
I would argue.
Please do. Just jump right in.
Uh-huh. Your unfortunate viewing of this movie on a laptop.
Okay.
You were not part of the
don't let people know that
experience.
I'm going to see it in the theater.
I know you're going to see it in the theater.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's how we're here in like an office talking about a movie. Like, also, the reason why I make movies is so I can articulate thoughts visually and not have to talk about it. So just so you know, this is like my nightmare, Adam.
Yeah. Oh,
talking
well, you're
about
doing
my
wonderfully.
Movies, like my fucking nightmare. And I'm sorry if I'm boring, but that's I like to be exciting and articulate on screen because I really can't do it live in person.
Yeah, so but yet I met you probably half a dozen times in the past. Always wanted to bring you on.
So. Oh, but what I was saying was, and not to toot my own horn here, but like audiences in certain parts erupt into laughter. And you're right. I think it is more about a release and about
some of the violence might do that.
Yeah,
because it's so startling.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, it's some of the we were hinting at it. It's the post Dwight being interacting with Crossbow.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say that.
But delete that part.
But yeah, there are definitely moments where And we were surprised. There was a roar of applause after a shocking moment of violence just because of the weight and the stakes. You know, people love those releases. And we do have very typical cinematic scenarios, but I think we found our strength in making them non-traditional by making them awkward and ill-timed and just part of this rolling clusterfuck that you never get to see in movies where everything isn't always perfectly planned or timed or made convenient for, you know, oh, the second act is closing down. You know, we take these left turns because we had this inept protagonist. And as far as my disastrous opening to this podcast, I will say, to distill this movie, it was originally pitched to the producers at Film Science, and Yousef Jani and Vincent Savino. It's No Country for Old Men with a dipshit at the helm. And that is sort of the drive of the film, and that chemistry where we've seen it before, and it's this easy fallback to have a very clear goal, revenge, so much emotion and aggression behind that, and it's easy to compel a character and thrust them through an entire narrative. What we do is we close that traditional arc down really early in the film, and then we explore what might happen after, you know, Clint Eastwood or Charles Bronson might complete an act of vengeance. Like, but what happens the next 4 days? That's what I want to know. Mm-hmm. People are going to hear about it. It's modern society. There's cell phones. There's news reporters. There's all kinds of things happening around you, and the world keeps turning and doesn't just, you know, stop on its axis for your little indulgent revenge mission. Mm-hmm. And so that was really fun to explore. And that's when the film, I think, found its life. Right.
Tweet at Dwight's Revenge for more. It's a story about two clans, too. It's about, which is a trope, you know. But is it two clans? That's the question. Is it really just a story about two clans? Or is it something else? And you will discover how complex things really are as you watch the backstory unfold. There are hints throughout, and it's lovely in that way. It's very, very subtle and well done. It's called Blue Ruin, and it's going to be opening in New York and how many other towns?
It's going to be New York, Los Angeles, Austin, Texas, April 25th. And
April
it's going
25th,
to expand
Friday.
To 66 Friday. Theaters May 2nd and beyond. So we're super Terrific. Excited. I mean, we're shocked by our premiere. We were showcased.
They're really getting behind it.
Yeah, our world premiere was at Director's Fortnight in Cannes last year, and Radius bought it 2 hours after the premiere, so and they've been just strategizing. And what I loved about it was, you'll hear some distributors will want to, they'll worry about box office, and they'll shut it down after two festivals to save on like a few $1,000 here and there. But Radius's plan from the very beginning was to showcase the hell out of it and share with audiences and let it build word of mouth. So we've done dozens and dozens of festivals throughout the world.
Yeah, well, your U.S. premiere was at Sundance.
It was the U.S. premiere was actually at Fantastic Fest in Austin,
Fantastic
Texas,
Fest.
In September.
Okay. Pardon me.
That was where Macon and I kind of, I think we were able to breathe a little easier and do some high fiving because this was intended. This film is designed to be for both diehard genre fans and the art house crowd. Mm-hmm. And when we were again shocked at being accepted into Director's Fortnight, you know, we had won over the critical elite and the art house and the cinephile crowd, and we were talking about the politics of gun control and definitely kind of shifted our perspective and our expectations. But then when we came home to the U.S., it was at Fantastic Fest where our people are, and it was as warm an embrace there as it was in Cannes. So we felt, if nothing else, we definitely hit both targets.
Definitely. Because I can see this would be a very attractive to the European movie lovers, you know, and of course to
and
us unquenchable audiences for violence and and revenge fantasy.
It was all about, like, you know, having your murder and eating it too. No.
It's a good place to
stay. That's totally wrong. But it was about me trying to do these action sequences and have the gore score and the exploding
right.
heads.
Yeah,
but
definitely that will be – people will be gratified in that way.
But the key for me, both as a storyteller and as a father of three, it can't go down easy. I do not want high fives when people die in this film. I want shock and I want devastation. Mm-hmm. And we'll find moments of dark humor later on, but like it's all about that the conflict in me spilling into the conflict of the movie, and hopefully the audiences will come out not having this sort of cynical usual experience where either you have to root for 100 people to die, mm-hmm. Or you have to just watch a boring contained indie. Like you can do both here. It's a hybrid film.
It is. Real quick though, any other projects that you were shot or this is, I assume, been the center of your universe for some time. So, okay. But I didn't know if you maybe shot another film or something also recently.
Recently? Oh, no. I had a great run of shooting films. You know, I shot Matt Porterfield's I Used to Be Darker. I shot Brian Salveson's In Our Nature and Nate Meyer's Seagull Run, three in a row.
Yeah,
and,
I love that.
And that was fantastic. But because 2012 was when I stopped everything and made the full-on push to make Blue Ruin.
Yeah.
I have not shot
Good.
Anything
okay.
except for a few corporate videos because we did finish this movie. We wrapped production, but it wasn't tight and clean. We had to go back in February the following year and shoot, or January the following year, and shoot a pickup scene at a hospital. And then we went back to our day jobs, came back to the edit. And before we go, because I know we had a pretty slow start. You know, this is our first thing of the day, and we are... Macon is taking care of his baby boy Buck, and
who is the product of Macon and his wife?
Yeah, Lee Eddy,
yeah, a friend of mine.
Who is yes,
and colleague.
She actually, you probably wouldn't have noticed because it's a little buried, but her voice is the newscaster when Dwight is watching television.
That's great. Yeah, no, but I did notice her in the
Easter
end credits,
egg.
But mm-hmm. I did not pick up on that. I'm glad to.
Yeah,
I was watching Gia Coppola's film. Palo Alto, and picked up on Francis Ford Coppola's voice as the judge. It was just a voice work too. I love that.
Say he's got such a distinctive voice, though. You can't.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I haven't asked around yet. Not enough people have seen it yet. But I know we have to wind down. Did you have any other gigs coming, or this has been the sole thing you've done in a while, making?
Yeah, definitely. We spent a lot of the time last year kind of promoting this, and that's been a fantastic experience. But I kind of split my time between auditioning and writing scripts for future projects. So, we're kind of juggling a bunch of different things, and hopefully something will solidify and start to take off.
I'm sure it will.
I imagine the primary audience here is independent filmmakers.
I guess so.
Who knows?
Yeah,
but whoever's
it's true.
Listening, So, although Blue Ruin easily could have been a disaster financially and a cautionary tale for people to not follow, I think it's important to note that the things we did to make this happen were about trusting each other and ourselves as collaborators and not listening to sort of the actuarial assessments and foreign market strategies. It was about utilizing what we had. Mm-hmm. And trusting good friends who we knew were talented. Like Macon, I knew was worthy of building a whole film around. And we did it the wrong way. We didn't pay people well. We didn't pay ourselves well. But we just struggled through and focused everything on not fancy cameras or famous actors, but telling a story in a classical fashion visually. And I think that's why it stood out, is because we didn't to overextend and spend all of our money on a semi-famous person who was not invested in the project. It was just my buddy Macon, and he gave the film everything he had.
It shows.
And the camera was a little less resolution or less dynamic range than others I'd used, but it gave us the freedom to bounce around and pick off shots that we thought were impossible and run around locations like a light and lean documentary crew in some occasions. And again, focus on getting awesome actors on board for very few days, not asking too much. No one on the film that was a key part of the cast worked more than 5 days other than Macon.
Right, he's in almost every scene, or if not every scene.
Yeah.
But rest assured, filmmakers who are listening, the cinematography is at the hands of a very, very confident cinematographer. It's shot like a classic film. It's great.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations to you.
I wasn't just fishing for a compliment there, but I would say the filmmakers can trust themselves.
Yeah.
Use their friends, use their resources, and make movies that do break through. But as long as you're as long as you don't shit the bed. So good luck.
Okay, thank you guys very much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Hello, it's me. By my count, that's two of yours and two of mine. I don't know how this ends.
That's how this works, man. The one with the gun gets to tell the truth.
And now, in this final segment, my conversation with filmmaker Zach Parker, in from here, from Indiana, his home state. Had seen his earlier film, as I mentioned earlier, Scalene, some time ago, and was really anticipating his follow-up, which is Proxy. And it's currently in theaters and on demand. So here we go with my conversation with Zach Parker.
Do you feel up to talking about what happened?
Everything is just pieces, fragments. I couldn't tell you what was real or not.
This type of assault, it's almost always carried out by someone who knows the victim.
They say it gets better. But it doesn't. It never gets easy. I think you're the only one who understands.
What have you been telling people about Peyton?
Peyton? He was just right here.
What have you been saying about my son?
I don't know what you mean.
Stop lying!
Thank you very much, Zach Parker. Good to finally meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Although I have to say, I was at the rerun premiere of Scalene.
You were? Oh,
I was.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. It was a great, I love that movie.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And so since then, you've been sort of on my radar. And so
have we progressed or regressed?
I would say you started off with a bang. I thought Scalene was a strong. Was that your first feature?
My third.
Third feature?
Yeah.
Then maybe not. I'm kidding around. I'm sorry I haven't seen your. Let's go through.
You don't want to see the first two.
Oh, no? But so you can say that about your own career that you really took a big step up with Scalene.
Absolutely. Yeah. I made my first one in 2001. I was about 22 at the time. I had written it started writing it when I was 17. So that one's tough to watch now. It's a $12,000 movie.
Sure.
We did sell it to a very small indie horror distributor, so it got out there. It's on Netflix and all that
stuff.
Oh,
it is?
But yeah. Second one was a $39,000 feature. I made that in 2006. Came out in 2008. This company called Vanguard Cinema put it out.
Oh, yeah.
Again, it got out there a bit. So, but again, each film has put me in the position or opened some new doors to get the next one made, and that's what's important.
Right.
It's all about making the next one.
All right. Well, let's stick with this one, the new one, before we go to the next after that.
Right.
The new movie is called Proxy, and that was quite the movie.
Thank you.
Do you want to give it a little bit of a synopsis?
Sure. It's a tough film to talk about sort of ahead of time, because I feel that a lot of the joy of watching it comes in the reveals and the unfolding that comes up throughout.
And it's all about the unfolding as opposed to just one final thing. It's really about how
exactly
the story,
yeah. So I suppose, you know, that's in the most general terms, it's about this woman who who's close to the end of her term on a pregnancy, ends up losing her baby and joins a support group for other mothers who have lost children, and ends up meeting another woman there who's recently met with a tragedy in her life, and then things begin to get strange
in their relationship as it evolves. And
exactly,
yeah,
right.
And it also the woman who she meets is married to a character who is played by Joe Swanberg.
Yes.
So that's of note also. That's pretty notable. He's been on a few times on the show. I was almost surprised you brought up the opening sequence, because it's such a striking, way to start a film.
Right.
I try not to know, except also in the most general terms.
So do I. I mean, it's the best way, right.
Yeah, so if you're listening to this and you don't know what we're talking about because I probably maybe we've taken it out just because it kind of it's just so it's not like it gives away anything. It's a setup, obviously,
right?
But it does, yeah. Doesn't give it. So how did you write this story? How, because it is such a,
well, it is
so plot and driven.
It's a combination of several things. Number one, you know, you saw scaling. Something I'm very interested in is playing around with storytelling structure in a movie. I feel like that's one of the final frontiers of movies. You know, it's something that's probably played around with the least. And since we've been many generations of filmgoers now, I think that if you become this a cinephile, if you become this consumer of many movies, you know, it's tough to find things out there that surprise you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what always I appreciate as an audience the most is when I see a film and something happens that within it that surprises me. And so the beginning, you know, I knew I wanted to I also tend to sort of be what some would call a slow burn filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So with this film, I really wanted to hit people hard at the beginning, almost throw them off balance, give them the sense that anything could happen in this film. And that would then earn me time to start building character and building story, just with this sort of unspoken promise that something like this could happen again around any corner. Also, again, you know, because I feel that we're sort of used to the way that a movie unfolds, I was hoping to take some of those expectations and turn them on the audience. You know, every time you feel that you have a grasp on where the story is going, it would become something else, and it would become something else. And at the halfway point, it almost becomes a different movie altogether.
The pacing of the story reminds me, I wouldn't ever, by the way, expect you to compare yourself to this particular film.
Okay.
Because
I'm ready.
Although it would be kind of impressive to have somebody on who did do this, but the nuts to do it. But they would be nuts to do it. But it was as though it was like a Hitchcock film.
Sure.
That way. Right. I don't know if that. If
oh Alfred yeah, Hitchcock, I mean, Hitchcock is a huge influence. You know, as much so as you know. I mean, I'm huge admirers of Stanley Kubrick and Lars von Trier and Roman Polanski. Again, I think there's some filmmakers who just tend to take their time, and what, you know, the polite way of saying it is deliberate pacing. Exactly. Those that tend to like it call it deliberate pacing. Those that tend to not like it, they call it slow.
Well, Zach, what do you make? I mean, if you watch any of the big tentpole types of films, the cutting is so quick.
Right.
And it's all about quick cuts. So
yeah, I mean, I find that like if you try to even count 5 seconds, you know, like, I mean, the average film these days cuts every 3 to 5 seconds. To me, part of the language of cinema is it's just as important where you cut as it is to what shot you use or what lens you use or how you stage your actors. You know, like within the vocabulary of cinema, close-up means something, a master shot means something, a handheld means something, a zoom means something different than a dolly, and where you cut means something. And so I try to make every cut meaningful, you know, at least in my own mind, through my own justification, you know, that it needs to cut there. Like, there's no other place that it could cut at. You know, but again, it's just personal taste. You can't control what people's tastes are. Mm-hmm. All I can do is trust whatever instincts I might have and do what I feel is right.
Holding secrets from the people that you're closest to, you know, is also kind of a running thing that goes on.
Right.
And I'm wondering where you got inspired.
I don't know. You know? I guess I'm a bit fascinated with just the whole idea of deception, and especially with misdirection. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of the where a lot of the magic lies in films is when you, hey, come look over here, you know, like a magician does. You know, it's always about, you know, again, misdirection, showing people what they think they're seeing, but really you're seeing something different.
And betrayal. You never know who you can trust in this movie. You know?
Right. Well, I don't really subscribe to the whole protagonist antagonist theory, you know. I mean, I just feel that it's been done to death and it's not really that interesting anymore, you know.
You don't give like the viewer necessarily somebody to hold on to.
Right. But I mean, I'm not looking for, I mean, again, it all comes from sort of an audience perspective, my own personal audience perspective, which is I'm not so much interested in, you know, like who can I connect with or who's the hero and who's the villain, but are these people interesting to watch? Like that's kind of more what I'm after.
So were there any films that you were particularly inspired by?
I think it's a mixture of every film I've ever watched. You know, yeah, I mean, I feel like you know these influences filter through you both consciously and subconsciously. You know, there are just those that become more prevalent than others. A lot of people after watching it compared, you know, some of the sequences to Brian De Palma, which is incredibly flattering. You know,
sure.
It was never anything I was conscious of while making it. You know, because it deals with some slow motion sequences. But once the first person brought it up, was like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I can see that
right
now.
Which, of course, by generationally, he's very influenced by Hitchcock
exactly,
as well.
Right,
so,
right.
So in a way, that's kind of what filmmakers are passing along the baton or whatever.
It's
They're
true,
passing
right.
along, you know, the That there's a lineage, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Yeah. So in the casting, we have mostly women in this in the film, with the, again, the exception of Joe Swanberg.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to cast these particular actresses?
I was working with an agent.
They are so unique from one another. And,
right.
And yet, you know, they have to have this kind of chemistry, and obviously is...
Exactly. No, I wanted all the characters to be, the four leads to be completely different from each other, you know, very specific.
Mm-hmm.
I met Alexia and Alexa, who play Esther and Melanie,
right,
through an agency that I was packaging the film with, which is actually the same agency that Margot Martindale is with, who was the lead in Scalene. Right.
Yeah.
And so Margot was very, you know, pleased with how Scalene turned out, and she really helped me out with sort of vouching for me with her agency, with like, you should pay attention to what this guy's doing next.
She came to Brooklyn, for God's sake.
Exactly, right. So the way it works with an agency is if they like your script, they'll start submitting suggestions to you for what clients they think are right for it. You know, these are two very dark roles. You know, they have some pretty challenging aspects to them, and so that I was looking for those actresses who are going to embrace those challenges and in my mind, sort of fall in love with the material for all the right reasons, like really get on board with the film I was trying to make. So I met with several different actresses, and Alexia and Alexa just seemed to really get the character and really get what I was going for. And we're sort of enthusiastic about going down that dark road.
Were you going against type in the sense that they were, the on the surface, these are really attractive?
Right.
Really,
right.
Really pretty.
Exactly.
Look almost like, you know, wholesome in a way. You know?
Exactly. No, I think that contrast makes it more interesting, and you become less suspicious of these characters, you know?
Right.
So that was definitely key.
Yeah. I mean, Christina might be, the character of Anika might be a slight exception.
Right.
With her tattooed self and all, right? And Joe Swanberg.
Right. I met Joe, sort of a friend of a friend, through Adam Wingard,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, You Are Next and Horrible Way to Die.
Right.
Of course, I was familiar with Joe's films, but I was seeing the work he was doing with Adam, and he had seen Scalene, and I sent him the script for this one. I thought that at the same time it was something that would be right for him, but also it was different from anything that anybody had really seen him in, but, you know, a different type of character than people were used to seeing him in.
Right.
Or seeing him play.
Right.
So, He got on board pretty quickly. He read the script, and I remember he called me and said, like, that's some fucked up shit, but it sounds like fun, so let's
he said,
go for it.
I might shoot one or two of my own films during the course of the...
We had to push back our schedule by about a week because the financing for Drinking Buddies came in at the last second, and so he went directly from that set to ours.
Uh-huh.
He was with us for about a week and a half, and I remember that during his off time, he was editing Drinking Buddies in his hotel room while we were shooting.
That's
and then he went right off to do The Sacrament, I think, right afterwards.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one, The Sacrament.
It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you... Scalene wasn't a horror film.
Right.
I wouldn't say it was a horror film.
Some called it a horror film, and some called this film a horror film, but I
thought it was going to be, you know, when I was going into it, I really thought it was going to be a lot more of a horror film. I would say it's a suspense film. I mean,
right.
I don't know if they're...
I suppose I'm most always reluctant to use the word horror because I'm afraid it's going to set up the wrong expectation for audiences,
sure.
You know?
Right.
I don't want them to think there's going to be murder and mayhem every 5 to 10 minutes, you know?
Right.
It certainly deals with very dark subject matter, and I think that's what lends itself to that genre, but I think it's a
And there are bursts of
hybrid,
violence.
Really. Yeah.
Right, no, I thought that, right, there's no supernatural element to it at all.
Right.
It's scarier because, again, it's about, you know, a volatile human behavior.
Right.
And something about, you know, deception and keeping secrets is much more disturbing because, let's face it,
right?
It's real in real life. That we know that there are people walking around this way.
Humans are the scariest monsters out there, you know, aren't they? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, the humans are what frighten me the most.
What's that?
Humans are what frighten me the most, you
sure.
know?
Yeah.
And what humans are capable of is what frightens me.
I'm Detective Oler with the Richmond Police Department. There was a break-in in that area.
I don't know anything about that.
I saw you with your son.
When I came back, she was talking to you.
What was she saying?
You need help, Esther, and it's not coming from me.
I need names. Give them up.
I would never hurt you.
I found something that I felt I should tell you about.
Who was she?
Don't you see?
And now the film is coming out. Tell me, is it coming out Today is Wednesday. So is it coming out Friday? It
comes out Friday.
Okay.
It's coming out. We have a sort of limited theatrical release. So it's opening in New York and LA on Friday. And it's going to roll out to, I think, around 10 or 12 cities over the next few weeks.
Right.
But it'll also be available on all the video on demand services like the same day. Friday. Yeah.
Appropriately enough.
Exactly.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Richmond, Indiana.
In Indiana?
Yeah. And all of my films have been shot in and around my hometown.
Yes, right, right. Okay. Yeah. And is this, because Indiana is pretty much archetypal middle American.
It is.
Midwest.
Absolutely. Fairly conservative.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you still use the term Hoosier?
Yes.
You do? Is that really, do people from Indiana use that
yes.
term?
Yes.
Okay. I'm taking off all these answers because I
do.
Can finally know for sure. And so growing up in this small town, I assume you grew up in a relatively small town?
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get introduced to film? Were your parents watching movies at home, or did you just hit the...
They were always, I mean...
Have, like, a cable.
I was, my parents divorced when I was pretty young.
Okay.
And so I was one of those, and both of them worked, so I was one of those generation of kids that just grew up in front of the television.
Mm-hmm.
And always had that's the world that I knew, and I always felt I had a connection to movies in a strange way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those kids where my dad brought a video camera home when I was 11 years old, and I just started making movies with it.
At 11. You had a natural penchant for it?
I just had a curiosity. How did it work? How did you edit? How did these images come together? And since I was still young, at the time what was popular was clay animation.
Right.
The California sure. Raisins, the Domino's Noid. So the first movies I made were clay animation movies, trying to figure out,
Stop
animation,
right.
How long can I press the red record button for and stop it? Because you're editing it all in the camera, how much delay did it have before and after to try to make it work and make
right.
these things move? And then I just, as I got older, I started making movies with my friends and then, get into school. And instead of doing that book report for that book, could I do a scene from the book, like shoot a scene or,
really?
It always felt like the teachers, were always so impressed, like, oh, you're going to go shoot a movie, you're going to shoot a scene. But to me, that was much less work because
yeah,
it
yeah.
was so much fun.
Sure.
And again, you're just editing it all on the camera. This is before any kind of NLEs or anything like that. And, mm-hmm. and pre-internet, too. So the only way I could try to figure out any answers to these questions was to just go out and do it myself. I mean, my local library had no books on making movies. Nobody I knew anything about making movies. So I just started making them to try to figure it out.
And also, stop animation is it's a great way to, develop precision.
Right.
Of course. And it's funny because I have a cousin who did the exact same thing. He started just at home.
Oh, really?
With stop animation, clay, doing that kind of thing also.
It might be why I'm still kind of minimalist in the amount of shots that I use, because you had to do a lot of work to change a shot up when you're doing
right.
stop motion.
Yeah. Did you go to end up taking film in college?
I went to a university in Muncie, Indiana for about 2 years called Ball State University.
That's where David
most famously
Letterman
David Letterman's alma mater is what it's most famous for. And then I had a professor there who had recently transferred over from the UCLA Extension Program, and he pushed me out west. So I went to school out there for a year. My first job ever was working for Roger Corman on this TV show.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, I was 19 when I moved out there
mm-hmm.
and got a job as a PA on Roger Corman's show Black Scorpion, the TV series. And I worked on that for about a year. And the good thing about working for Corman's group is you get to work up the ranks pretty quickly and you get to have your hands in everything. And I always felt that my job, if I wanted to be a filmmaker, be a director, was to learn how to do every job on set. And so I worked in the camera department, worked in the lighting department, worked in the production office, and just learned how a set, because the only movie sets I'd ever been on before were my own, which were essentially just me and my friends. So I mm-hmm. wanted to learn how it really worked. And so after being out there for about 5 years in freelancing, I moved back to the Midwest to start making my own movies.
So have you been in Indiana?
I've been in Indiana it was L.A. for 5 years, Chicago for a few years. And then my wife and I were married and we had our first child and we moved back to our hometown. And we've been back there almost 9 years now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're just, I was just wondering if, since there's probably no community out there.
It's quite small. There are people who are making movies. It's mostly short films or a couple features, but it's tough for the films to break beyond the boundaries of the state. Usually they'll have a few kind of public screenings, that the filmmakers themselves will arrange, and they'll try to sell a couple DVDs, but then it tends to go away.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
There's no tax incentive there right now, though there are some people who are lobbying for one. But sure. It's becoming as the budgets get a little higher, it becomes increasingly difficult to keep films in Indiana. It's hard to justify the cost and not getting any kind of tax incentive. So
what are you doing between films?
I have 3 kids. That keeps me busy.
I'm sure it does.
I'm a stay-at-home dad. Uh-huh. My writing partner on this, he's a stay-at-home dad. He has 3 kids, too. So We just kind of rely on each other, and we get our kids together. We're all friends. And most of my kids are in school now, though, so that frees up my days a bit more. And so as the films progress, it gets busier and busier. But that's what I've been doing back there for stay-at-home dad by day, filmmaker by night.
Right. And there is a little thing. I guess you have Skype and email. And
right, yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about, with technology being as accessible as it is now, is that, you can live anywhere.
And so you never put up in the whole festival thing. I mean, obviously you will for Proxy.
I've been to several. Scalene went around quite a bit, and Proxy's gone about even more. I think it's played in over 20 festivals now, and I've been to probably half of those.
Where
or
did
more.
It premiere?
It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival last September.
I have not heard of that one. No, but Fantastic Fest makes sense.
Yeah, Sitges.
Oh, it looks great.
Yeah, played at the Scary Movies at the Lincoln Center here last fall.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was recently, about 2 months ago, there was you brought up Sacrament. They had a screening of it, maybe not even that long ago. I wanted to see it, and I'm trying to get Ty West. Ty West,
yeah.
On the show.
Yeah, Ty and I have been programmed quite a few places together. We were just in Glasgow together at Fright Fest Glasgow. So I saw it for the second time there.
I guess that's coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, I think it is. It's late May, I think.
Oh, good.
Early June, yeah.
I'll probably get him in here then. That'll be good. I really would love to.
Great guy. And he's worked with Swanberg a ton, too.
So. Right, yeah. I've seen pretty much everything at this stage. I don't know. Something about what this generation of guys are making is there's something compelling.
Well, I mean,
but there is something intelligent going on here.
I think it sounds incredibly biased, but I mean, a lot of my favorite films this past year have been by friends of mine. I haven't seen The Guest yet, so I'm excited to see Adam's movie, The Guest.
It's Adam Wingard?
Adam Wingard's new film, The Guest, yeah. Yes. Premiered at Sundance this year. Mm-hmm. Ty's film was really great. Jeremy's film, Blue Ruin, which comes out next week, too, which is fantastic. And Evan Katz's film, Cheap Thrills. I mean, I've known these guys for years, and so it's just great that they're finally getting their works really being seen and appreciated, and, they're doing some amazing stuff.
Yeah. I just talked to Jeremy and his lead actor, Macon Blair. And I'm doing a TV thing with them on Tuesday. Hopefully this will.
But Jeremy has 3 kids too, so we have
yes, of course.
We share that bond.
Yeah. So you found a family on the festival,
right,
among filmmakers, regardless of being out in the middle of Indiana there.
That's right. Right. Well, again, it's social media. We all met each other on MySpace days.
Right. Right. Well, again, Proxy will make its premiere here in New York and LA on the 18th of April at the IFC Center, I'm assuming.
Yes, and the Arena Cinema Hollywood in LA.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Play both for a week, I believe. I'll be at the 10 o'clock showing of Proxy here at the IFC Center on Friday, and then at the 9:45 p.m. showing on Saturday in LA.
Right. So great. So check it out. It's a great, compelling, terrifying as well. So bring a friend. But it's a highly entertaining movie. It's called Proxy. The filmmaker, again, is Zach Parker, and I'm so glad that you were able to finally come on, and it was nice to get to meet you, too.
I appreciate you having me, and I'm glad you enjoyed the movie.
Not a whole lot to tell you. I'm going to try to put up another segment later in the week or next week with Meg Griffiths. Megan Griffiths has got a new film called Lucky Them, which is her, I don't even know how many, she's made a bunch of features now, and she's a super talented filmmaker making great movies in a prolific manner, I might add. So I'm hoping to bring that up, put that up. I'd like to put it up during Tribeca, but I just don't think realistically there's going to be time. So maybe we'll hold on to it until Meg's theatrical. So I don't know if I mentioned this, but when I had my little car accident last weekend, I got a gash on my face from my computer. It hit me when we upon impact, and I went to the hospital, and I had stitches put in my chin, and my hard drive on the computer died. Well, fortunately for me, this time I learned, because, you know, last year when I went to South by Southwest, my equipment was stolen and I lost a couple of segments, including one with Bob Byington and a few others. Well, this time, I was smart and I've always kept a backup. So I did, even though my computer died, I did lose a couple of segments that I had already edited. So we're going to be working on that. And then I'm going to put those up. And one is with the guy who is the runs the organization Real Works. His name is John Williams. He's a lovely guy, and it's a great organization. So I'm going to put that up shortly. Another is Jamie Wilkinson, who is the founder of an organization called VHX. And we're going to put that show up shortly, and more. So do continue to stay tuned to the show. It means all the world to me that you are listening and responding. And I have a few people who have reached out recently, want me to, you know, bring them on or bring on people, and I will get around to all that. As I always do. Ultimately, between Tripeca and the recent little accident, it just put me a little off my normal routine. So forgive me for that. And if you could do me this kindness, and that is, the next time you're on iTunes, or please do just take a moment after this or during this and go to iTunes, you'll find Film Wax there in the store. It's an easy search, Film Wax or Film Wax Radio, and you could put in a star rating. It takes a few seconds, and maybe even a comment. Be straightforward. Let me know what you think. You know, so of course, if this is assuming you subscribe on iTunes. Of course, many of you may be listening through the Rooftop Films website. Today is as I record this, it is April 22nd, and Rooftop Films, they announced their summer slate. We're going to be putting up that live show very shortly, where Dan Nuxtall also does talk a little bit about it. And now it's officially out there in the world. You could, probably go to their website and get the press release and learn all the films that are coming out. And I'll talk more about that on the next episode. So thank you very much. You can find us on Twitter at FilmWax Radio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/FilmWax Radio. You can also get in touch with me directly by emailing me at adam@filmwax.com. Okay, folks, I'm going to get out of here. It's getting late. You're listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and hosted by Adam Chartoff. Thank you so much. Until next time, have a good few days. I've never seen you look like this without a reason. Another promise falling through another season passes by you. Smile away from anybody's face, and that's a desperate way to look for someone who is still a child in a big country dream. Stay with you like a lover's voice across the mountainside. Stay alive. I thought the pain and truth were things that really matter. See the sun in winter.